Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 325. Do not adjust your television sets. I do indeed have a bit of a head cold, but we have a lot to get to, so listen in carefully. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, drop us an email. Send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay, and of course, stroll on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Head cold or no, we have so much to get to, and we must start with our guest. Jeff Graham is the executive director of Georgia Equality, an organization that works to advance fairness, safety, and opportunity for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities throughout the great state of Georgia. Jeff began advocating on LGBT and AIDS-related issues as a college student in the mid-1980s, and he has continued this advocacy on all of these issues since that time. He spent well over a decade working with the AIDS Survival Project, first as their executive director and then as their senior director of advocacy and communications. He has received more awards than I could possibly tell you about, but they've come from just the greatest organizations like the National Center for Human Rights Education, the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta, the Atlanta City Council. He's got proclamations. He's been named a defender. All these different things. It's incredible. He's a current board member of Pro Georgia and the National Equality Federation. And right this second, he's here with us. Jeff Graham, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much, Ken. I'm looking forward to it.
Jeff, we would have no time to chat if I listed all of your awards.
You're very gracious. Thank you.
So this is what I have been able to gather through my crack research. For what I'm seeing a Texas theater boy starting out and then suddenly nonprofit work.
That actually is a good way of doing it. I grew up in Colorado, so always, you know, home props to the state where I came from.
Yes.
But I've been doing all this work ever since I was in my late teens in the South and starting in Texas. And yes, it started off very much in theater. And it changed to nonprofit, but what the important thing that was there in between was frankly what was going on with HIV and AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s. And so, I was one of those crazy folks, and there were a lot of us back then that actually used our theater background to pay the bills so that we could be activists. And after about 7 years of doing that, which really was what I considered my job to be, being involved very specifically with ACT UP, some other radical LGBT organizing. I was lucky enough to then be able to make this my full-time paid job about 20 years ago.
Wow. And what do you get out of it? It's my favorite question to ask, you know, people like you, Jeff Graham, what do you get out of doing this nonprofit work? We'll talk about the specific work of Georgia Equality and the AIDS Survival Project, but how does it feed your soul?
It feeds my soul because when you refer to it as nonprofit work, it doesn't even feel like that.
Yeah.
This is my life.
Yeah.
I am so lucky. I am able to live the life that I, starting in college, I realized I wanted to do. That, in theater, my art, always passionate about it, something that gave so much to me, but really being able to know that I am hopefully making a difference in the world is what ultimately became more important to me than just making sure that the play went on, making sure that that the sets looked good and the costumes looked good, that people knew their lines. At a certain point, it really became much more about trying to make an impact on the world. And I just feel very blessed and extremely privileged that I have been able to do that for a long period of time.
Yeah. So I'm one of those weird folks, Jeff, that I kind of straddle those generations at 38 years old of certainly being alive in the 80s and the early 90s, but not necessarily having the cultural awareness to really understand what it meant to do HIV and AIDS-related work during that time. How do you go about describing the experiences that you had to folks who are trying to understand what was the climate like?
Sure. One of the ways that I described this to folks is that by the time I was 23, 24 years old, death was a common experience in my life.
Yeah.
And it created a tremendous sense of urgency, that we were still in a period, and this is what gets so hard for people to believe. There wasn't any government funding. There
Right.
were no governmental programs. There was so much silence and stigma and then active, violent hatred against people living with AIDS, against the LGBT community. And it really was a sense that if we did not take care of ourselves, no one would be there for us. And it did feel very much like a war. Mentally in my mind, that's a lot of how I think about those times. There was a great camaraderie, and it sounds so morbid, and certainly large parts of it weren't, but it was also an amazing time of feeling like we really could change the world.
Yeah.
And we were mostly young people, although there were folks in their 30s and 50s and 70s that were our elders, that were sharing stories and giving us very good advice and right there in the trenches with us. But for the most part, it was a movement, and it really was a social movement that was organized by people in their mid-20s to mid-30s. So it was also a youth movement. In the late 80s and 90s. And we had to do it out of a sense of urgency because no one was
right.
going to do it for us. And it was this youthful zeal that we could change the world. And in many ways, when you look back on it, I think we did succeed in some important ways, but also in some small ways of just having, being there for other people in their final moments of life.
Yeah.
I mean, there really is nothing more special than to be able to share a sense of love and being with someone who doesn't have a whole lot of other people, who's been rejected by perhaps the family that they grew up with, their coworkers, that we could create that sense of family, create that sense of community, and create that sense of being. So while we were out trying to change the world, we were also trying to just be there in a very intimate way for each other.
Yeah. You know, one topic that's come up so many times over the past 7 years of doing this show is the type of activism that was executed in the 80s and the early 90s versus what is going on now. How would you go about characterizing, do you feel a difference between the type of activism you did then and what it is that you do now, and any strengths we could bring forward or any things we would tweak back then?
Yeah, what I do today is so very, very different than what I did 25 or 30 years ago. Leading a state equality group, it is working with elected officials. It is working in the legislative process. It is very much being, for the most part, inside the system, a part of the system. I wear suits and ties way more often than I ever
right.
even wanted to, much less dreamed that I would back in those days when it was a Doc Martens, a racy T-shirt, and a leather motorcycle jacket that was my uniform. So in that respect, the work itself is light years different. But there is that same sense of passion and urgency that I try to bring to the work even today. So the way I like to characterize it isn't that my work is necessarily different. I'm just using different tools in the toolbox. And the one thing that, 25 or 30 years of advocacy and activism, the one thing that's taught me is that when you're really building something, you need access to a wide variety of tools. And there's different times and different places that you need all the tools in the toolbox. And I don't usually or often participate in civil disobedience and direct action these days. And it's been a few years since my last arrest. But one, I don't discount it for the future. Anything can happen. But two, I am given great hope when I see things like the Black Lives Matter
right.
movement that has been going on. That is so much that same spirit and intensity from the ACT UP days. Just like ACT UP was the spirit and intensity of the early queer movement and the feminist movement and the anti-war movement of the late 60s and 70s. And so I think that you know, there may be someday that generations don't need this. But right now, I think kind of every generation finds their movement. And that's what I encourage young people to do. Find your movement and really dig in. That's when you can begin to change the world.
So what I hear you saying, Jeff Graham, is that you are trying to get arrested by the end of this interview. Am I getting that right? Did I misunderstand?
I'm always never opposed to it. It's probably about time that I dusted off a little bit of that part of my resume again.
That is
but,
so
you know,
funny.
These days, especially being here in Georgia, that is such a conservative state, dominated so much by Republicans and conservative Republicans at that, I know that there are folks. If I can get legislation through the Georgia legislature, people will benefit by that.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a compromise for me to be able to find ways to both sleep at night and work actively with Republicans, trying to find common ground. And then can we build upon that common ground for the greater good of the LGBT community and for people living with HIV and AIDS? Those are my two focuses. I work a lot in coalition, and so I hope we can bring poor people and people of color and other disenfranchised and attacked communities on board with that as well.
Wow.
But, you know, someone actually has to take the time to try to work with some of the conservatives and some of the Republicans, because if we wait until the political environment here in Georgia changes significantly and becomes a progressive state, we may be waiting for a long time. And again, that I'm glad that there are young voices and voices from the far left that talk about idealism and push us towards the world that really is the world that we aspire to. But there's some folks that need to kind of work with what we've got right now to try to make the world a little bit better for those folks that are suffering right now or doing without right now or are completely locked out right now.
Well, let's talk about Georgia. I have not been there, and I couldn't even tell you how long. On behalf of the Georgia Tourism Board, sell our listeners on the great state of Georgia.
Georgia is a wonderful place. 25 years ago, 26, 27, when I just came here, I came here because I was following a boy. He had an internship. We decided we were falling in love. I moved from Texas to be with him. Luckily enough, 27 years later, we are happily married.
Look at that.
So I made the right choice with that.
Nice.
But what I found... Atlanta was supposed to be a six-month stop while he was finishing up his internship. And it took me a while to figure this out. But there is a great sense of resiliency here in the South. There are a lot of great things in terms of the spirit of people who grew up here and the people who live here. There's marvelous natural beauty. The weather is fantastic. We get four full seasons here, but they're not really harsh. The winters are not harsh. The summers, July and August, tend to get a little bad with the heat and the humidity, but that's what air conditioning is for.
Exactly.
You know, so I think it's a really wonderful place. And for someone like me who is really so interested in trying to make the world a better place, there's a lot of fertile ground. There's a lot of work to be done. And, if you're willing to just be here and dig in for a while, you have to make a commitment to it. The good thing is it doesn't take that many years before you can look backwards and say, wow, I actually did make an impact. I did move the needle a little bit. And then, frankly, from kind of a political, purely political perspective, things for folks around the country are not going to solidly change until we can change the politics of the South. Yeah. If we really are one United States of America, we need to make sure that there is no region that gets left behind. And that's a lot of what the current work here in Georgia looks like. But, you know, like I say, from a tourism perspective, we've got mountains, we've got the ocean, we've got everything in between, we've got great food, we've got amazing neighborhood festivals here in Atlanta. And in fact, Atlanta Pride is coming up the weekend of October 10th and 11th. It's always around National Coming Out Day. The time of year is beautiful, and I encourage anyone and everyone who's never been from around the country to an Atlanta Pride, come to Atlanta Pride and see what you've been missing all these years.
This entire segment brought to you by the Georgia Tourism Board. That was great, Jeff. That was great. Again, listeners, we're here with Jeff Graham, the Executive Director of Georgia Equality. What brought you to Georgia Equality? You were talking about digging into this work. You didn't just dig in. You became the Executive Director of Georgia Equality. That's pretty extreme form of digging in, Jeff.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been about 8 years that I've been here now.
Yeah.
You know, when I first took the position, the joke around town was that if you complain long enough and loud enough that you could do it better, that someone will eventually turn to you and say, fine, you try.
You do it, yeah.
There is a certain amount of that it was just kind of my turn, you know, to be a part of it. It is something that I'm so glad that I did take on. It's a daunting task. It's challenging, as we've already talked about, to kind of do this work, especially in a conservative state. But I really hope that what I've been able to do is bring the tools and the passion and the perspective that I learned first as a street activist, then working so deeply in the intersections of HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. With people of color, with poor communities, with rural communities, with so many marginalized communities that society has just forgotten over and over and over again, to bring all of those things together to then work in the more conservative, buttoned up realm of legislative advocacy and political action. Working with elected officials, influencing elections. There's a lot of things that I do today that I frankly fought against and really discounted and I did not like 25 or 30 years ago. But I have really come to a realization that at the end of the day, before you can have a sense of lived equality, so that you can really live your life regardless of your gender identity, regardless of your gender expression, regardless of your sexual orientation, that you can have a full productive life free of fear and free of harm, someone has to create a legal equality. You've got to make sure that the systems and the laws and the policies, the very structures of government themselves, don't automatically shut you out. And so that's the perspective that I've tried to bring to the job of now being the person that tries to change the policies, tries to change the laws, and in the hopes that other folks are, well, I know that other people are picking up the mantle of social activism, of artistic expression, of really pushing the boundaries of what we understand the LGBT community to be and how it fits into the broader mainstream community and society.
Nice. Well, let's talk specifics. You know, as you look back over the past 7-8 years, talk to me about one of those moments where you just kind of raised your arm up in the air and said, yes, that is a point where we move the needle.
Several years ago, we had been working on safe schools legislation, really wanting to pass anti-bullying and harassment legislation here in Georgia that would have legislation that would specifically include sexual orientation and gender identity. And we had been very close, but we had continually failed with that. And a lot of the organizations, you know, really marked us that, you know, unless you had a state law that was enumerated, that specifically included in the state law sexual orientation and gender identity, that you were just failing LGBTQ youth and youth in general. We unfortunately had a young man, 11 years old, who committed suicide. And it was a result of his classmates taunting him for being queer, for being gay. I don't know if he actually had a sense of his own gender identity or sexual orientation at that point in his life. But he was artistic. He had a bit of a speech impediment, and he was an immigrant. So he was an outsider in many different ways. The school district, and it was actually a school district here in Metro Atlanta, the law at the time did not define bullying and harassment as something that could occur in elementary schools. And so the school district didn't have any policies for it. The school acted in a really horrible manner. They just told him that the way he should look at it when students called him gay is that gay was another word for happy, and so they were jealous of how happy he was. Mm. Didn't work for him, of course. Didn't work for his peers. We were able to convince a Republican legislator who I lived in the same district where this young man had killed himself to really champion the cause of safe schools. And we were not able to get the carve out for enumeration in sexual orientation and gender identity. So in one respect, that was a failure. But we were the organization when everybody else, with the important exception of the Anti-Defamation League, Georgia Equality and Anti-Defamation League, that led the charge to change the law. And the way we did it was also to force a change of every single school district around the state would have to adopt their own policies. And the great moment of victory was, one, the State Department of Education, in their sample policies, did recommend enumeration and did recommend sexual orientation as a category that school districts should take a look at. And then 2 years after that law passed, we had been able to work with enough school districts in the state of Georgia that today 63% of public school students are actually covered by enumerated policies that include sexual orientation, and about 45% of public school students reside in a district that specifically mentions gender identity and gender expression. And so it's far from perfect, but man, we've really been able here in Georgia, conservative red state Georgia, throughout the state, been able to make some changes and some awareness that have really affected the lives of young people.
That's actual work and moving the needle forward. That's great stuff. That is great stuff. You know, we've talked to so many of your colleagues who work with these statewide organizations across the country, and you've given several shout outs to working with communities of color. And it strikes me that one of the differences is that you actually have a sizable population of communities of color in Georgia, you know, with some of your colleagues in other states who, particularly up in Vermont and Maine, who are struggling to get folks on their board and get folks involved. Talk to me about how you do this cross-racial work and involve more communities of color in the work of Georgia Equality.
Sure. You know, some of that is by taking a specific look at what our legislative priorities are.
Yeah.
So a good example of that is, you know, when I came on board in 2008, after the Proposition 8 defeat in California, you know, there were a lot of conference calls, a lot of meetings throughout the movement of, you know, had the LGBT, the broader more mainstream LGBT movement with this push for marriage, were we actually engaging communities of color? Were the priorities around marriage the same as the priorities that perhaps LGBT people of color had? And so throughout part of that, with my own history of HIV advocacy, I brought a proposal back to my board of directors and to, you know, some of our donors, because I wanted to make sure that they were on board with this, to really stepping up and highlighting our work around HIV and AIDS.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of involved with some of the inner circle stuff around HIV research, I knew that the CDC would soon be announcing that HIV infection rates were tailoring off in most demographic groups, with the one exception of gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. So I knew that that report was going to come out. It did actually officially come out in 2009, 2010 is when there became an awareness of that. And then last year, there was a study that was done by Emory University here in Atlanta that showed locally in our own metro Atlanta area, young gay, black, and bisexual, and other men who have sex with men have an annual HIV infection rate of right around 12%, which makes it one of the highest HIV infection rates, frankly, in the world. And so we focused in on this as an issue area, built a strong program around that, and it has been something that was specific to engage communities of color that we knew, the black gay and bisexual community, to try to give voice to an issue that we knew was a top priority to them. Other ways that we do this is frankly recognizing that sometimes the best thing that we can do is create a space where other groups can take the lead.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'm very intentional to allow people of color-led organizations to really be first out front on issues such as sex workers or immigration, and how can we as an organization then come in as a supporting role. And then finally, just, you know, making sure that there is space available for basic community organizing. So in the grand scheme of things, Georgia Equality is still a pretty small organization. Our budget hovers, for the first time this last year, we've gotten our budget up to around $1 million. We're at a 6-person staff. So in the grand scheme of things, we're still a small organization, but we are now the big organization in Georgia.
Yeah.
And so I feel we have a sense of responsibility. One of the projects that we've taken on is called the Philip Rush Center. Atlanta has not had a sustainable LGBT community center in decades. And so we worked with our colleagues at the Health Initiative, which does health services and advocacy for the LGBT community. And we have created a facility that now is home to 10 LGBT organizations, 5 of which have offices here. But we are also able to then open our doors. Every year, there's about 100 organizations that use our facilities for their own events, their own programming, to be able to have board meetings. We are able to create enough of a donor base for the Philip Rush Center that organizations that have no budget, have no staff, they don't get charged to use the space. And about almost half of the groups that use the space over the course of any type of, over the course of the year, are led by people of color. And so that's kind of our organizing strategy, recognizing that, you know, a lot of that trickles over as goodwill towards Georgia Equality, trickles over as people actually participating in our own programs and our lobby days and our training, but then also just a greater sense of building community as a whole, because folks, we're able to use our successes as an organization to prop up groups that are even smaller than ours.
Jeff, you almost make it seem like it's important for various groups to work together.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. It's
what
amazing.
What a wild concept, trying to work together.
So I have to ask you, you know, this work, as I think you perhaps know, this work can be a little bit draining. For some nice role modeling for all of our listeners out there, how do you take breaks? How do you separate yourself from the work in order to recharge?
A long time ago, I gave myself permission to not attend every single event,
yeah.
That I get invited to be able to say no sometimes. And it's really hard to do that. But I do try to do that. And for me, I think the greatest thing is to recognize that even though this is my life and it's really hard to separate, where Jeff the advocate and Jeff the professional and Jeff the private person begin and end. At the end of the day, I have a small group of friends that I've been close with throughout most of this time. All of them have an interest in politics and advocacy and LGBT issues, but most of them don't live it and breathe it and work on it. And so that's kind of how I'm able to pull myself away, is that there's just lots of times that I can go and hang out with my friends and I don't have to discuss the big politics. And that, frankly, at the end of the day, I consider myself very much of an introvert. And so I've had to learn that saying no to events or leaving an event early sometimes, and not getting involved in all of the gossip and socializing. Right. If I don't have the energy to do that, just giving myself the permission to exit quietly through the back door if I need to.
I think you are the first three-time introvert Grand Marshal of the Atlanta Pride Parade. Just putting that out there. You have our listeners across the country just devouring your every word. What can we do to support the work of Georgia Equality?
Well, I think, since you've got listeners that are all around the country, I think first is people, invest in your own communities. Invest in your own state equality group. And that's certainly a financial investment is important, but it's also an investment of time. Know what they're doing. Be on an email alert list. Know the actions that are taking place. Regardless of where you may find yourself on the political spectrum, the state equality groups are really doing work that will, in one way or another, impact your life. And so it's important to know what those groups are doing. Secondly, when I say invest in your own communities, find an LGBT organization, if you're not already connected, that speaks to you some way. And volunteer some time, whether that's the local film festival or whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement, whether it's a square dancing club. I think that we are still at an important time in the LGBT movement history where a lot of folks are going to feel we don't have to have LGBT-specific spaces anymore. And we're moving into that, but we're not quite there yet. And so continuing to just share each other's company and build community is critically important. And then finally, for folks that are more specifically interested in Georgia Equality, visit our website. Find out what we're doing. If you have friends or family members that are in Georgia, encourage them to get involved with us. One of the biggest challenges we have is identifying people who live outside of Metro Atlanta who will be willing to meet with their legislators,
right.
Their state legislators, their local city council members. And frankly, until we can build those one-on-one relationships between friends and family members, LGBT folks that are not afraid to come out with those elected officials and make true the axiom that all politics are local, that really is true. And people, a lot of folks grew up from the South and live elsewhere. So the people who live elsewhere, that's how you can support us, is by telling your friends and family members, the folks that are still here, to get involved out of a sense of the love and frankly obligation that they have for you.
Nice. Last but certainly not least, I give you the floor, Jeff Graham, Executive Director of Georgia Equality. Here is the space where you get to speak however you will about the staff, board, and volunteers of Georgia Equality.
I could not do this work if I didn't have an amazing team of people around me. One of the things that just I think speaks to how inclusive we are. One of my field organizers is a middle-aged straight black man. He's really doing so much of the hard work. And he does it with such relish, and he's able to have conversations with folks that I cannot. Everyone is here and dedicated. They work so hard. The staff is absolutely amazing to do our best to actually get out around the state, see what's going on with folks. And that's critically important. We've got donors that stick with us and have stuck with us for years and years and years. They're critically important to thank and acknowledge at all times, because without their support, we wouldn't be here. And finally, it's the board of directors, that the board of directors has so much trust in me and the staff that they're there as our safety net. They're there to help guide us, but they really are there to support us and promote us in what I think is sometimes some pretty innovative and out there thinking for a statewide equality group.
Such great work being done there in the great state of Georgia. Listeners, everybody needs to stroll on over to georgiaequality.org, and you can learn all about the amazing work being done down there. My gosh, I want to come visit, Jeff.
You've got to come down here, Kim.
All right. I'm on it. I also feel a little bit of disappointment. My goal was to get you arrested. We didn't get anywhere near there. In fact, I feel like this is interview number one of seven with Jeff Graham. We barely plumbed the depths of all the great work you've done. On behalf of everybody living there in Georgia and all across the country, I mean, Jeff, such incredible work that you guys are putting forward. You are most certainly lifting up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters there in Georgia, and certainly inspiring the rest of us. Just such great tales and such great role modeling for the rest of us to do to really lift up some voices and create the equality that we're all looking for.
Thanks, Ken. We're all in it together.
GeorgiaEquality.org. Jeff Graham, what an absolute treat.
Thanks, Ken.
The sun is coming, your body's warm, the grass is cold, but the summer's over and I can't spend another day kicking down the dirt road. Georgia, you find your 10 feet tall. I could only love you more and more. But is any time we say goodbye? And I can't help crying.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, a little bit of time left on this week's episode so we can get to all the latest LGBT news out there. We're actually going to start, you know, with me, because I wrote a new piece for the Huffington Post, and first of all, let me just say, I absolutely give up trying to figure out what it is that people are going to devour and what it is they're not. I certainly recognize at this point it's not correlated to the effort that I put in, which is not to say that I don't put in 100% of effort into each and every piece, but sometimes I think, well, nobody's going to read this one, and then they do, and it catches me off guard. And such was the case this week with a piece that I put out there called The Problematic Case of Danny Pintaro. Let me walk you through it a little bit, because I really, again, I'm so caught off guard and pleased. It's great when people read stuff and provide feedback, but I cannot believe how much attention this piece is getting, and I'm hit some sort of nerve. Let me pause here and say I am so appreciative for the opportunities that I have been given to get my voice out there. You know, this is what we tell you every single week, what we've been telling you for the past 325 shows, that everybody has their way of getting their voice out there. I feel extraordinarily blessed that I have this opportunity to do this radio show and to be able to submit pieces to the Huffington Post that people check out. I hope that people understand, like, I am just so blessed and I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And the cool part is I can write a piece for the Huffington Post and then I can go on the radio show like I'm doing right now and expand on it a little bit more and maybe even explain a couple pieces. So I wrote about Danny Pintaro. So let's talk about Danny Pintaro. So Danny Pintaro, he was on Who's the Boss, which was a big part of my upbringing there in the 80s. He was on 196 episodes of Who's the Boss. He was the little moppet. I called him a moppet in my piece because he had the bowl haircut just like I did. Jonathan Bauer. We were the same age. We actually are the same age. And so I loved watching him on Who's the Boss. He came out years ago. As the tale goes, the National Enquirer was about to out him. So he actually took the reins and said, okay, let me, before I get outed, take control of this situation and out myself. And certainly wasn't his choice, it sounds like, to come out when he did, but certainly stepped up and said, okay, I want to have control over how this story is going to be put out there. Well, this is what has been happening if you've not been following. Let me catch you up. He appeared last week on Oprah's show, Where Are They Now? They're on the OWN network. And on that episode of Where Are They Now, he revealed that he has had these past interactions with crystal meth, and as part of his background, he's actually been HIV positive for the past 12 years. And it was a bit of a bombshell, and we haven't been hearing about that much, celebrities coming out as HIV positive in the news. And so, extraordinarily brave announcement, has the platform of Oprah. There was this part of me that's like, okay, not perhaps the most relevant celebrity out there anymore, and he's very upfront in saying he's a manager at P.F. Chang's, and this thrusts him right back to the national spotlight. So a little bit of a cynic in me thinking, all right, you know, this serves his needs as well, but doesn't really matter. Anytime we have people stepping up and saying, by the way, I'm HIV positive and I'm here to combat stigma, I'm here to put a face onto this disease that we're not really talking about as much anymore, total bravery, has my respect, yay. As part of his press tour, and he was all over the place. He was on the Oprah show, on the Where Are They Now, and then he went over and appeared on Huffington Post Live. I don't know if I'm getting the actual chronology of his press appearances right. And then he was on The View. Well, this was a disaster of an interview. It was a complete disaster of an interview. He was interviewed by, because it was a little kitschy as well. It wasn't just about him and interviewing him. It was getting him together with Candace Cameron and Raven Simone. And so it was a child star thing. So it had that little undercurrent. It wasn't much of an undercurrent. They kept shouting it out. Hey, child stars unite. They did this interview. And I know Candace Cameron Bure, I'm actually not sure how to say her married name, but Candace Cameron from Full House, Raven Simone from The Cosby Show. Candace Cameron, who has been known to espouse unbelievably conservative views, certainly not as much as her brother Kirk Cameron, who we've talked about quite a bit over the past 7 years on this show, because he's just plain nutty with the anti-gay views he puts out there. But she has certainly put some conservative things out there. And Raven Simone, who also has said kind of some nutty things where, yes, I have a girlfriend, but do not call me gay. I do not identify with the label gay. So I don't know what happened here with regard to Danny Pintaro not in any way looking like he was prepared for what he got. And what he got was Candace Cameron completely shaming him and saying, do you take responsibility for your promiscuity, and really, really shaming him. And then Raven Simone turning around, trying to, I think, alter the tone, but asking his husband, not Danny Pintaro, started by the camera panning to Danny Pintaro's husband and saying, do you guys practice safe sex on national TV? And then it was a really extraordinarily awkward moment. There was also a moment where Raven Simone conflated HIV and AIDS, which are not the same thing. And Danny Pintaro was not coming out as saying, I have AIDS. He was coming out and saying, I am HIV positive. And those are two completely different things. Obviously, there's a relationship there, but they are different. Yes, disappointed in how these two View co-hosts interviewed him, but also there was this part of me thinking, who prepared Danny Pintaro for this interview? Where was his indignation? Where was him saying, hey, that's an inappropriate question? And by the way, he had more than a few opportunities to say that's an inappropriate question because he was asked several inappropriate questions. And so it's really frustrating to see his responses to this. And by the way, and I didn't write about this in the Huffington Post piece, but I would just like to put out there that because people have said, oh, you know, how could you possibly be prepared for what they said? Okay. So let's just say that he wasn't prepared for that, which I think he should have been. That's just my opinion. I think he should have been prepared for that. He then went out there, as did his PR team, and hyped that interview on The View like crazy with nary a mention of the fact that this was a really problematic interview. So he put out there on Facebook and tweeted, check out my great interview. Well, wait a second, it wasn't a great interview. So, yes, in that moment, he didn't respond. Maybe he was caught off guard. Maybe he wasn't well prepared. But even after the interview, there didn't seem to be an acknowledgement, hey, this was really problematic. So that was really disappointing to me. And by the way, in that interview, he said he's on this Beacon of Light press tour that he has named. And in that interview, he acknowledged, I don't yet have the relationships with these different LGBT and HIV and AIDS related organizations. And I think that that should have been established before he went on this press tour, because I think he would have had access to individuals who are well-versed in media savvy around LGBT, HIV, and AIDS-related issues who could have prepared him to say, hey, wait, you're going in to talk to Candace Cameron and Raven Simone on The View? Here's some things you should probably be prepared for. So I think there was a real lack of preparation on his part. He has since established a relationship with HIV Equal, which you know, do I have some inside knowledge there? Yeah, I do. This isn't, by the way, my research. This is just things that I know that are easy for you all to find out. HIV Equal is directly associated with his PR team. Yes, it is another agency, but it's an agency represented by the same PR team that represents him. I feel like I'm doing muckraking now, and I'm not. I'm just so frustrated with how this story has come to pass. So, okay, fine. He's got the bravery, and he came out as HIV positive, which was huge on Oprah's Where Are They Now? And yes, the interview on The View was so terrible, and yes, his follow-up to that wasn't great, but okay, maybe they caught him off guard. Maybe he's just learning as he goes, even though I have higher expectations. But then he does an interview with Us Magazine, and this all totally falls apart. In the interview with Us Weekly, this is what he said. He says that he contracted HIV through oral sex, and he has this quote. He said, quote, "A compromised immune system, having been up for a long time, drugs, rough sex, all of that combined with lesions in your mouth, body fluids, it's that easy," end quote. So, for people who have been writing me and saying, yes, you can get HIV through oral sex, I acknowledge that it is possible to get HIV through oral sex. I understand that. The CDC says it's essentially unprovable. I am not standing up and saying, hey, there is no way to get HIV through oral sex. So people who think that's what I wrote, that's not what I wrote, and maybe I could have done a better job. Maybe I wasn't totally clear, but I am saying on this show, So Gay, my other platform, I am not saying that you can't get HIV through oral sex. I am saying the way that he presented this with that really pat and ridiculous phrase, it's that easy, totally diminishes actually how statistically difficult it is to get HIV through oral sex. Again, it's not that it's impossible, but the way that he diminishes the possibility, this statistically unprovable possibility, but still possible possibility, really makes this so problematic. Not just about Danny Pintaro standing up and saying, I got HIV through oral sex, but the way that he diminished it. And then he went on to talk about the man who gave him HIV, from whom he contracted HIV, and he totally shames that guy and says the lifestyle, this is a quote, quote, "the lifestyle he was leading was really irresponsible." Totally shame that guy in much the same way that Candace Cameron shamed him. So it wasn't just about the oral sex piece. It was, again, this larger picture of Danny Pintaro really not knowing how to work the media with regards to HIV and AIDS and LGBT-related issues. Now, some of the response has been, and I appreciate all the positive responses, which I truly do, but some of the responses have been, okay, you're turning around Ken Schneck and shaming him. Okay, this is not a guy who is wrestling with stigma and silence. People have appropriately highlighted, okay, maybe he's presenting oral sex in this way and diminishing it because he's dealing with some stigma. Absolutely, that's entirely possible. But this isn't a guy dealing with his stigma in silence. This isn't a guy who is toiling away behind the scenes wrestling with his stigma. This is an individual who voluntarily stepped up. He's not saying, as he did years ago, hey, I'm about to be outed, and so I'm going to take control. This is a guy who is voluntarily stepping up and saying, I am of my own volition coming out as HIV positive. And he's got the national spotlight, and he's got a microphone in front of him that transmits his words to millions. And so because he is stepping up and doing that, I actually do have the expectation that he be better at what it is that he is doing. That he establish relationships with these LGBT, HIV, AIDS-related organizations to get the training he needs before he voluntarily steps up and reaps the benefits of being a budding activist. Now, apparently this coming week there's going to be another interview with him on HIV Equal's website, and there are teasers out there about this. Again, HIV Equal represented by the same PR team that represents him, and it's being touted as, hey, are you frustrated or upset with the interview on The View? Check out this interview. I am calling it right now, and I probably will return to this next week on our episode. I am calling it right now. I will guarantee, maybe I'm wrong, except I'm guaranteeing it. There's nothing that you get, by the way, for me being wrong. I'm just putting it out there in a bold way that he will not be denouncing the interview from The View. Because from what I'm understanding, this HIV Equal interview was done right after The View interview. So I'm going off about this, right, for 12, 13 minutes. And it's just because it clearly has struck a nerve, and yay, the people are responding and getting people talking. But it's not about oral sex. It's about the way that this individual who is reaping benefits, right? This is really helping his career and putting his name back out there. He is presenting himself in a way that's not helping our community. Getting people talking is not always the best thing when there are those of us who have to run around like crazy, and people who are way more knowledgeable than me, but people who are running around like crazy and trying to clean up what he's saying because he is shoring up stigma. He is voluntarily putting himself out there. He's got the national spotlight. With that comes responsibility. That's what Stan Lee tells us, folks. With great power comes great responsibility. And I am putting out there that I do not think that Danny Pintaro is using his great power in the most responsible way. I know, I just dominated our news segment just talking about me and what I wrote, but this is how passionately I feel about someone who voluntarily puts himself out there. Which is not to say that there isn't other news out there, because there is other news out there. Let's touch on it briefly. California Governor Jerry Brown this week signed three, count them, three, folks, major pro-LGBT bills into law. One is a first-in-the-nation bill requiring that companies doing significant business with the state provide the same benefits to their trans employees that cisgender, non-trans workers receive. The measure, authored by Senator Mark Leno, prohibits any state agency from entering into a contract in the amount of $100,000 or more with any company that does not offer equal benefits to all employees, regardless of gender identity. California is the first state to enact such a law. It goes into effect on January 1st. That's huge. That is totally huge. He also, Governor Jerry Brown, signed a bill updating the laws governing assisted reproduction in ways that will benefit LGBT Californians. Assembly Bill 960, authored by Assemblymember David S. Chu, provides that unmarried couples using assisted reproduction to become parents will be recognized as such on the same terms as married parents from the moment their child is born. It removes the requirement that a doctor or sperm bank must be involved when using assisted reproduction in order to ensure that the donor is not a parent. And this bill provides clear direction as to how egg donors should be treated under California law. It also goes into effect with the new year. So just to be clear, previously the law did not mandate parental recognition for unmarried couples. The new law is important to LGBT families because many of them use home insemination rather than sperm banks. So that was law number two that is going to go into effect. But as I said, there's law number three. Governor Jerry Brown signed the LGBT Disparities Reduction Act, which will allow state agencies that oversee public health to collect voluntarily shared data on the sexual orientation and gender identity of the people they serve, just as they collect other types of demographic data. If the agency sees significant health disparities related to these characteristics, they must report them to legislators and the public. This one, by the way, is the least sexy of the three pieces of legislation, and yet this is so huge. I have talked about this before on this show, is so gay. Yes, research is not the most sexy, but when we collect data on our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, we actually can make a huge difference in creating policies, in creating new procedures that support the health and wellness of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. Currently, in any number of data collection efforts, we don't collect information on sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. And so when we add those criteria to our data collection efforts, we actually can craft policies and procedures that will support the community, right? It's kind of common sense, and yet it often doesn't happen. We don't have the data. So Governor Brown signing into law that we will now collect this data will make a huge difference. Huge, huge difference. So kudos to everything going on in California. Very exciting news. Exciting news in Pennsylvania. Brian Sims, Democrat Brian Sims, who is Pennsylvania's first out gay legislator. He is now announcing his run for Congress. So we will certainly be keeping our eyes on Brian Sims, who is now running for Congress. Very exciting. Mike Huckabee, who is running for the Republican nomination for the President of the United States, he is talking about Doritos. We talked about Doritos a few weeks ago. Now, Mike Huckabee is also talking about Doritos. He is, this is what the Advocate says, they're using a little pun here, folks. Mike Huckabee is, quote, not going to let the chips fall where they may, especially not Doritos rainbows, which, just to remind all of you, that's the special edition of the chips created to raise money for efforts to stop anti-LGBT bullying. We talked about it a few weeks ago. We had a representative from the It Gets Better projects. You can go to thisshowisogay.com and go back and listen to that conversation. Although manufacturer Frito-Lay has run out of Doritos rainbows, that's how successful this campaign was, Mike Huckabee is no less determined to keep them from being purchased, along with all 30 brands in the snack maker inventory. The former Arkansas governor, who again running for the Republican presidential nomination, he claims that Frito-Lay has partnered with sex columnist Dan Savage in teaming up with the It Gets Better project to, of course, do harm. That's what he is saying. He's saying it's part of a gay-friendly agenda. This was his quote. It is beyond me to understand how a responsible corporation would think that partnering with someone who spews the vicious vitriol that Savage does would be worthy of your corporate contributions. He went on in this letter to say that, quote, tolerance for Frito-Lay's brazen corporate support of hate speech by Dan Savage, that were it directed toward Muslims, would warrant a Justice Department investigation and prosecution, that this is all chipping away at the very character and soul of the American experience. So, to recap, Doritos rainbows chipping away at the very character and soul of the American experience. Strong words from Mike Huckabee. Not surprising, but still fun to report. In a really not great story for the LGBT community, apparently indoor tanning and skin cancer rates are very high in gay men. Indoor tanning is far more popular among gay and bisexual men than it is among heterosexual men, a fact that may explain why gay and bisexual men are also experiencing higher skin cancer rates. This is all from new research from the Internal Medicine Department at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. This is a quote from the study's co-author, Dr. Matthew Marsh. He said this, quote, overall, the rate of indoor tanning among these men is between 3 to 6 times greater than it is among heterosexual men. And he also went on to say, quote, gay and bisexual men also have about twice the rate of skin cancer compared with heterosexual men, both in terms of melanoma and non-melanoma. Hey guys, gay and bisexual men, stop tanning. Stop tanning. Let's get rid of this part of our community. It's actually leading to skin cancer. This is a bad thing. We don't need to be tan. That's not something that we need. Please don't do it anymore. That's the public service announcement brought to you by Ken Schneck. I don't know what research we need to do to conduct to reduce the tanning efforts in the LGBT community, but whatever we need to do, everybody tell a friend, tell them to stop tanning. We don't need to be tanning at 3 to 6 times the rate of our heterosexual brothers. We just don't. So let's stop it, because guys, it's causing cancer, and that's bad. There you go. Public service brought to you by This Show Is So Gay. And that, my friends, is really all the time we have left for this episode of This Show Is So Gay. Our huge, huge thanks to Jeff Graham. My gosh, that is a guy I could talk to for episode after episode after episode. He's got such a rich history in working with the LGBT community, making such a difference with all of the amazing folks volunteering and working for Georgia Equality. Go check them out, georgiaequality.org. Huge thanks to all of them and to Jeff Graham specifically for being on this week's episode. You guys, you know what to do. Get out there and go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. Whether you are doing some volunteering, whether you are writing a piece for the Huffington Post, whether you are starting a conversation with people around you about tanning, there you go. Go do it. Go make a difference. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?